Well, I'm very glad to be able to get this opportunity to speak with you guys tonight. If you want, we'll mainly be in Hebrews chapter 11. That's where the bulk of our lesson is going to be tonight. We'll be flipping around throughout the Old Testament as well, and a little bit into the New Testament along with Hebrews. So we'll kind of be all over the place tonight, but that's okay. So the title of this lesson is A Legacy Worth Fighting For. If you can see here to the back of me, I can see it up there, so I don't have to look back there. You can see there are three men here that are on a life raft. This was taken from a movie. I did not take this picture. I'm not that expertise. But anyway, we're looking at a picture of three men that are stranded supposedly on in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. What had happened was that these three men, it was around the 1940s, it was May of 1943, these three men were stranded in the Pacific Ocean because they were going to rescue a plane, yeah, that's what it's called, a plane. A plane had crashed in the middle of the ocean, and they went to go rescue it using another plane. However, their plane had caused problems. There were 11 men on that plane, and 8 of them died, and these three are left alone on a life raft together. After 47 days, all they had was a flare gun. They had a fishing pole. They had half things of water, half jugs of water, and I think one or two Hershey's D-ration candy bars. If any of you guys have family that was in World War II, you know that those Hershey candy bars did not taste very good. They were known to just be something to get someone in the military through a rough time. It was just basically just to get calories into someone who had been fighting all day. And so that's all they had on this raft. And after 47 days, they were eventually captured by Japan. To say that, you know, that was a blessing was honestly not even close to it. Honestly, it was probably even worse that they were captured by Japan, who was an enemy of the United States in the 1940s during World War II. They became prisoners of war, actually one of the men actually died during those 47 days. So there were two men left that were captured by Japan, and they were punished. They were beaten severely. If you know anything about Japan's World War II history, is that their prisoner of war camps were anything but a shelter. They were very destructive. Their goal was to eventually kill each and every prisoner that was an enemy to Japan. And so these two soldiers had to endure so much abuse, so much neglect, and starvation. And eventually, they wanted to. One of these guys in particular felt like the main culprit or the main person that had that was getting the worst of the punishments. And that guy's name is Louis Zamperini. He is a why he was picked on so much by the Japanese was because he was known to be an Olympic runner. He was an Olympian in the 1936 Olympics. He at one point had the high school mile world record in the 1930s, which come to be it, when you become an Olympian, you know, there's a lot of fame that comes with that. And he had a very big image across the world because he had qualified for the 5K in the Olympics, and he placed 8th place, so he was one of the top 8 best runners in the world, but specifically he ran the fastest last lap out of anyone in the competition. That's how hard he worked and how hard he wanted to win. And even Adolf Hitler recognized him for that achievement, for running the fastest last lap in the 1936 Olympics. And so it was a big deal that he was at this camp. Because of that, the Japanese army specifically took out even more of their punishment on him. And it was absolutely horrifying to see that. He had to clean latrines. He had to shovel coal. And if you ever coal mined, you know, it's a very hard job to do. Eventually, he ended up getting the disease. I believe it's called beriberi, which is a vitamin B1 deficiency. And so he almost died many times when he was at this camp. However, he eventually survived, and by September 5th of 1945, he was finally able to come back to the United States. And he was known for his unbroken spirit, which someone has written a biography on him, and the movie Unbroken, if you've ever seen that, is about the life of this man. So why do I tell you this story, this really unfortunate story? As I was thinking about the lesson, I was thinking about his life is so much like... it's unlike anything that we've been a part of, I'm sure. But he was living out truly a legacy. And I think we can all look back on a life like that and really see that is a life that is maybe not necessarily fulfilling, but it is truly amazing to see what he went through. And we can learn from those things. The endurance that he showed, not just in his competition and his running abilities, but also through what he had to endure at the camp. And so I think about how each and every one of us are living out a legacy, whether we realize it or not. Our stories, our lives, impact people in some sort of way. And the definition of a legacy is the impact of events or actions taken. And I think about someone like Louis Zamperini is a very great example of a legacy. But some of us may have good stories that we tell, good legacies that we know of. Maybe our parents or our friends and family that have had a very significant impact maybe in our faith. But also, a lot of people that we know of that do not have such a great reputation or a legacy that have shaped how to not be like someone or how to prevent that. But the Bible has so many examples of great legacies. I mean, throughout the scriptures, you can see so many stories of men and women who have lived faithfully. But also, there are examples of men and women that haven't lived very faithfully, that haven't left a good legacy, or rather a poor legacy. So each and every one of us have a story to tell. Everyone has a legacy that they're living out right now. And so as we look at Scripture, I want us to think about some of the poor legacies that we see in the Bible. And the first one is Haman, as we go to Esther chapter 3. In Esther chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, Esther 3, verses 1 through 6, it says, after these events, which is talking about after Esther had become queen, and Mordecai had also saved King Ahasuerus from an assassination attempt. After these events are going on with the kingdom of Persia, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. So Haman is a new guy in town, a new sheriff in town, and he is promoted to almost second in command, even above the princes in the region. And it says, all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. He disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So looking at these verses, Esther becomes queen, and Haman is also another character that comes into play. He is almost as high as the king and queen, but not quite. And I don't know how he got to the position he was. Obviously, he did a lot of smooth talking, as you can see, that somehow it just went over the rest of the kingdom's head that he wanted to kill a whole nationality, and they were okay with that. So somehow he had used his words to get exactly what he wanted. But, you know, as we read the rest of Esther, you guys know the story that Esther confronts Haman for what he's done, for him trying to kill the people, the Jewish people. And Haman ultimately ends up being killed for it, because he was focused on himself. He wasn't focused on the well-being of others in his position. Rather, he was using it as a way to get even more power and show how much greater he is than the people of God. But of course, God always finds a way to make that not happen to someone like that. So we see that with Haman, that was a poor legacy. And ultimately, there ends up being a holiday to celebrate the victory that Esther had helped do. And then we get to John chapter 12, and we talk about Judas Iscariot. That's another poor legacy that we can look at in the Bible today. A preacher had talked to me a little bit about this. I heard it in a sermon one time about Judas Iscariot, and you know, of course, you know, his reputation, as soon as we mention the name, you know, that is the person who betrayed Jesus. But you know, you kind of wonder sometimes how was he even getting to be a part of the 12 disciples? Well, I mean he was a follower of Jesus up until some point when Satan had taken over, when he had allowed Satan to rule him. And it says here, Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving. But Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was intending to betray him, said, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? Now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. You know, Judas already had a problem with money. As we can see here, he was stealing from the money box, and here comes Mary, who is absolutely at the feet of Jesus, literally, and wiping his feet with her hair and with the fragrance that is here of pure nard, which is very expensive in the Middle East at that time, and yet she is showing 100% submission to Jesus, saying that she is all in on whatever he is about to do, and yet Judas uses that moment to distract everyone from what she's actually trying to do there. He is distracting them rather and focusing on himself. Another example of that, just like Haman was. Judas was focused on himself because he wanted the money for him. He didn't want it to help benefit the church. He just wanted it to benefit himself. And unfortunately, you know, he allowed his temptation with money get the best of him. And so all he saw were, I would say, dollar signs, but they had denarii back then. So he saw a denarii, and he wanted that for himself. So he asked the chief priests, how much would you give me if I were to give you Jesus? And so that's another example of a poor legacy, is that Judas had decided what the money was more important than the moment to spend time with Jesus. And so we see that as another example of a poor legacy. Then the last one, it's a lot similar to Judas Iscariot, Ananias and Sapphira. Right before this, a man named Barnabas had come in, and he had given a piece of his land, a good portion of his land, to the church to help establish that and help give that to people in need, and give all the money to the apostles. He's giving a lot away, and the church is absolutely thriving at this point in Acts chapter 4. And then we get to Acts chapter 5, where Ananias and Sapphira, who is probably a rich couple here, you know, it says in verse 1 that they sold a piece of property, and they kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge, and bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. And then right after that, Ananias and then later Sapphira fell down, and they strike down dead because of the deed that they have done. You know, I don't think it was necessarily that they had given, that they hadn't given everything up, but the problem was their heart. Their heart was absolutely not in the right place. You know, each and every one of these people, they have, the example was, they were thinking about themselves. They were not thinking about the well-being of other people. You know, I think about Sundays when we're giving, when we're able to have the opportunity to give to the church. And this church has been so blessed, and they've blessed each and every one of us in some way. But, you know, I can't help but think that there's times where even, and I'm guilty of this too, where we come in and we just do not feel like worshiping. We do not feel like giving everything to God. And that's what happens to Ananias and Sapphira. They did not give everything to God. Their heart was not in the right place. And so how many times do we come in and we think, oh, church has to cater to me? How many times do we think that, oh, if I'm here, you know, and there's this opportunity, maybe someone else can take my place. Maybe they can teach class this Sunday, or maybe they can help with the event that's supposed to go on here in the next couple of hours or whatever. They don't. Some people, you know, we kind of sometimes fall into this trap where we think it's all about me. But that's not the legacy that Jesus left behind. No, Jesus left behind a legacy that serves others. And that's what we're going to be looking at in Hebrews chapter 11, is the legacy of those that have lived, these legendary legacies that have made decisions to honor God rather than honor themselves. You know, that I can't help but think about that, you know, and I am just as guilty of that, where we feel like we can't stay another few minutes after service just to fellowship with our brothers and sisters. Instead, we're concerned about trying to beat the Baptist to the restaurant, you know, 5 miles downtown, you know. We're concerned about that rather than trying to fellowship with one another. Or we're concerned about, you know, how can I get out of something that I don't feel like I have to do. Rather, we're each and every one of us are called to use our gifts to honor God and to help with the church and help benefit others, rather than just thinking about ourselves. And so those are examples of poor legacies that we see in Acts and in Esther and in John. Now, I labeled these legendary legacies because each and every, you know, we like to call this the Hall of Faith. You know, each and every one of these people, there's around 15 people and even more than that that are mentioned here that have lived a life that was pleasing to God enough to where an author decided to write about it. They wrote about each and every one of these people and how they had faith. They had something that people of their time did not have, that they were different. And these are some of the traits that they showed that I think we can also take away tonight. The first example is Noah's hopeffulness. In verse 1, it says in Hebrews 11, "Now faith is the assurance, the confidence of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." Then we skip to verse 7. It says, "By faith Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." Noah had decided that, hey, I'm going to have confidence in what God is doing right now. You know, in Genesis chapter 6, you know, humanity had gotten so bad to where God had felt sorry that he even created mankind. But Noah was who stood out to God, and he said, "I want you to build an ark for a flood that you have no idea what's coming." And Noah trusted in that. He had hope that God was going to save him and his family from the terrible flood. And he did, and God always prevails. And Noah could have hope that his family could be safe. And the next thing is, another trait that we can find is that Abraham and his deep understanding. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3, it says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible." And then we skip to verse 8. "By faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." Abraham, you know, even though he had made mistakes during his time, you know, he never lost sight of the faith that he had in God, the understanding that this is what I'm here to do. This is what I'm called to do. I'm called to help bring a new nation to this new land. You know, Abraham was so diligent, and he was so wise and so understanding that he knew that God was going to take care of him no matter where he went, no matter where he traveled. And that God trusted him enough that he wanted Abraham to carry on a new generation, a new nation through his faithfulness, because he understood how amazing God was and how amazing he continued to be and the provider that he was for him through those times. Then the next thing we can look at, another legendary trait, is Enoch. In Hebrews 11, verse 5 and 6, it says, "By faith Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death. And he was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him." Enoch eliminated all the distractions going on with his life, and he literally got to walk with God. He understood that I need to seek him throughout my entire life. It is not something that I can only just do each and every once in a while. I am here to, my life here is to please and to seek him constantly. And we can see that, that faith, it's impossible to please him who comes to God, and for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Enoch had the reward sitting out in front of him. He had his eyes completely on the prize, and he did whatever he could to continue to live right with God and do whatever it took to love him with all of his heart. And the last thing is Moses' endurance. And in Hebrews chapter 11, we'll skip to verse 24. It says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward." Moses had the same thing going on in his life. Moses had it all made. We know with our teens studying the whole first quarter about the Exodus that Moses had it all made. He was taken from the basket from the Nile to be in the kingdom of Egypt and get to be raised by the Pharaoh and Pharaoh's daughter. So he had an inheritance to some extent to the throne, and he could have just stayed there. And then as he ran away to Midian after he killed the Egyptian, he could have stayed there. He could have stayed there and just became a shepherd to Jethro and just continued to do that for the rest of his life. But no, it says here that he chose rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God he chose to endure that. When God called him to see the burning bush and to talk to him, Moses didn't have to go to Egypt. I mean, it's pretty important if God tells you to do something, you should probably do it. But he did not have to. And I think about that and the traits that these people have, the hopefulness, the understanding, the seeking, and the endurance that each and every one of these people in Hebrews chapter 11 had. They had each and every one of these traits, but ultimately, more than anything, they got an opportunity to decide what their legacy was going to be from there. And I want to offer that to you guys as well, is that we all can choose how we want to live out the rest of our lives. We have a decision to follow God. We have a decision to obey him. We have a decision to endure the things that we are going through right now. I know sometimes hope may seem lost. endurance may not always be there. We may not always have the deep understanding that maybe we once had, or maybe that we haven't been around as much, or whatever that may be. We can still decide what we can do with our legacy. You know, Satan believes that our legacy ends at the grave, but Jesus knows that for us that it starts at the cross. That's where our legacy starts, is at the cross, when we remove all of our pride and all of our guilt, and we allow God to be at the forefront of our lives. We allow Him to take the reins, and we allow Him to be our ruler and our Father. And why is it so great that we get to decide what it is, what makes Christianity so great of a legacy? Well, it's because in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 40, it says, because God had provided something better for us. That's why. Because God had provided something better for us. Each and every one of us have the opportunity to be a part of something great. We each have the opportunity to follow God. Nothing is holding us back from following Him. The only way that it may be holding us back is maybe it's pride or gain or guilt or shame. But, you know, Jesus paid for all of that at the cross. In Hebrews chapter 12, in verses 1 through 3, which is where we'll close, it says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You know, God invites us to run to him. He invites each and every one of us because of the people that we see here in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. We see with Moses, with Noah, with Enoch, with Jacob, with Isaac, even with Rahab. Rahab's also mentioned here. They all had decided that they were going to follow God. They all decided that by faith that they were going to pursue God, even in the times where it didn't seem convenient or it didn't seem like it was a good decision at the time. They didn't exactly get to see the fruits of their labor, but if they could only see the blessing that they have been to each and every one of us today, as we read about these people, we can see that we can have a legacy just like them. But it takes a decision. Each and every one of us have a decision to fight. Each and every one of us have a decision to follow God. But the real question is, are you going to fight? Are you going to allow Satan to just trample all over you? Or are you going to say, no, that's not what you're going to do with my life anymore? Rather, God is going to be at the forefront. He's going to be at the center of my life, and I'm going to obey him. I am going to endure everything for him. But the good thing is, he's already done that for us. And so we can be so thankful that he has already defeated Satan at the cross. And so the real question is, are you going to submit? Are you going to fight? Are you going to just allow God to be at the forefront of your lives? Or are you going to allow the devil to and Satan to continue to win over your guilt, over your shame, and over your sin? And so as we think about today, the question, are you going to fight? I do want to offer the invitation in that way is, are you going to allow God to help win your battles and help win your fights? Or are you going to allow Satan to continue to win? And so the good thing is we have water back here. I tested it out last week. It's fairly warm, so you should be good. If you're thinking about baptism, if you're thinking about putting Christ on in baptism, we'd love to come up and we'd love for you to come down and for us to talk to you and to discuss with you about that decision to follow Christ, to allow Satan to not rule over you no more. But also, if you are struggling with something in your life, maybe you have a loss or something had occurred in your life that you feel like you couldn't, that you just need some prayers or you need some encouragement from the church, and you feel like you just can't do it anymore. Allow us to help you to fight those battles. Allow us to help you with that. Whatever your need may be, come forward now as we stand and sing.